Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Before we begin, Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute prayerfully ask you to consider making a financial pledge of support during the critical month of June to stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. As we approach our financial year end, June 30th, you can give online simply by visiting equip.org or you can call 888-7000-CRI. CRI's outreaches are funded solely by listeners like you. Here now is your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. This is a podcast that is designated to bring to you the most inspirational, informative people on the planet. And today is no exception. Before I introduce my guest, let me tell you that Hank Unplugged is having an unprecedented impact around the globe. A recent Hank Unplugged review says Hank Unplugged offers a wealth of information and a comprehensive lineup of brilliant guests who you may otherwise never have the opportunity to experience. I found the podcast less than a month ago and have listened to every episode in its entirety since the very first introductory podcast back May 31st, 2017. Some several times over, they're thought-provoking, inspirational. This is just a reminder that the podcasts are entirely evergreen. And if you haven't heard every episode, we encourage you to go back and listen to any that you might have missed. Today, I want to talk about one of the most significant subjects that we could broach in the year 2019. If, in fact, climate change is what it is purported to be, we're going to spend tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy on this issue. And so often there are dire predictions, and it's very difficult to figure out whether or not those predictions will come true. But there was a time back in 1999 when I wrote a book called The Millennium Bug Debunked. And this was when evangelicals as well as secularists were mining the subjunctive. They were cultivating the seed of threat buried in each unrealized instance. And they were saying that when the calendar year turned in the year 2000 from 1999, January 1st, 2000, it was going to be the end of civilization as we know it. You talk about luminaries in the Christian world, James Dobson, at the time, D. James Kennedy, R.C. Sproul, many of them friends of mine, saying that this was going to be a global catastrophe. In fact, James Dobson said, when my book came out, that I was going to have the blood of millions of people on my hands because I was causing complacency within the body of Christ. And I remember at the time doing Hannity and Combs. It was Hannity and Combs at that time. And even Hannity, taking the conservative position, was saying, well, look at everybody is saying that this is true. There's a consensus that Y2K is going to be the destruction of civilization as we know it. So I not only had Combs arguing with my position, but I had Hannity arguing with my position. The reason I bring that up is there was an end date there. The year 2000, we would know whether Y2K was what it pretended to be, or we would know the opposite. In this particular case, it's very hard to know because we have luminaries who are telling us that climate change portends the end of civilization as we know it. Beto O'Rourke repeating what Al Gore said. Al Gore said in 2006, 10 more years, if we don't solve the problem, we're going to have catastrophic results. Beto O'Rourke said it this year. You have AOC saying the same thing. And we could go on, but we need not just to make light of this, but make sense of this. And to do that, I've invited a person that I think is among the foremost experts in the world on the subject, if not the foremost expert. His name is Dr. Patrick Michaels. He's formerly director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute. He's a past president of the American Association of State Climatologists. He was program chair for the Committee on Applied Climatology of the American Meteorological Society. He was a research professor of environmental sciences at University of Virginia for 30 years, a contributing author to the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize back in 2007. His writing has been published in major scientific journals. He holds degrees in biological sciences and plant ecology from the University of Chicago and has received a PhD in ecological climatology from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And he's the author of a new book coming out in November. Same time my book is coming out, by the way, with HarperCollins. His book is titled Scientocracy, The Tangled Web of Public Science and Public Policy. Dr. Patrick Michaels, I have looked forward to having you on the podcast and very, very interested in your new book, Scientocracy. So let's start there. Take us back to the end of World War II when our government began to intrude in the process of science.
Well, actually, we have to go to World War II when Vannevar Bush headed the Office of Special Programs, which included the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb. As that was progressing down the road, Franklin Roosevelt ostensibly wrote him a letter. Actually, Vannevar Bush probably wrote himself a letter and had the president sign it, in which he asked for ways to keep up the research effort of the size of the Manhattan Project after the project had ended and the war was over. And, of course, Vannevar Bush then proposed in a very quick fashion the essential federalization of the scientific enterprise in the United States. And that did evolve over the course of 10 years after World War II.
What happens when science becomes politicized, when politics becomes disguised as science?
Well, I think I might rephrase that question. What happens in scientific fields that are involved in the regulation of people's lives and lifestyles, when that scientific support comes from a monopoly provider, which would be the federal government? As you know, money does not get out of Washington with no strings attached. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, for example, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which is the central office for climate research and development in the United States, is on a mission to make sure that the issue is prominent and displayed generally in one fashion, meaning a dark and dire fashion, because if it weren't, the reason for its existence would go away. And as you know, federal bureaucracies and other bureaucracies often tend to have reason number one to just keep themselves in existence.
What I am trying to do, Dr. Michaels, is to have people get some kind of a grasp on what's going on. And I suppose to do that, you have to get back to the basics. One of the things that people read about, hear about over and over again is CO2 emissions. And it's always presented in a pejorative fashion. So when you hear of carbon dioxide, it's a bad thing, but is it necessarily bad?
No. Everything else being equal, if we have more atmospheric carbon dioxide than we had in the past, the surface and lower atmospheric temperatures will warm some, and they have warmed some. But that's not really what people should be talking about. It's not whether it warms or not. It's not whether human beings are a cause or not. It's how much it warms and how it warms. And what we have seen is that the warming that has taken place tends to be about one half as much as has been forecast to take place. And if you look at the way that the temperatures are changing, there is much more warming of the winter temperatures, and therefore the nighttime temperatures, than the day daytime temperatures or the summer heat. In fact, you know, if you look at the highest temperatures recorded every summer, say in the continental United States, we have good records that go back well over 100 years, and you will find no change whatsoever. Where you will see the change is the warming of the coldest temperatures of the winter. And I'd like to know, what's so bad about that? Because that is the way it's working out. And by the way, that's what theory predicts would happen also in a greenhouse warming.
But you also have, I mean, if you have CO2 emissions, it seems to me that you have plant food, you have longer growing seasons, you have the greening of the planet. Seems like you have some positive benefits that you never hear about.
You don't hear about them very much, that's for sure. But indeed, they're there. The reason that you hear all these negative stories is the previous administration, the Obama administration, tried to justify its climate policies based upon something that they call the social cost of carbon. It's a result of econometric models coupled with climate models. If you think that's a recipe for disaster, you're probably right. And the answers that you get are very highly predicated upon the assumptions you make going into the models. For example, what the future growth of wealth would be, say, in the United States. And they use numbers that I don't think were very defensible. I have submitted work along with Kevin Dyer-Ratna from the Heritage Foundation and Ross McKittrick from the University of Guelph, where we actually used much more realistic values for the future growth of wealth and much more realistic values for the enhancement of agricultural output simply by putting more CO2 in the air. And virtually for every iteration that we ran, the social cost of carbon actually became slightly negative. Not very much negative, but slightly negative. And if we were really using the language strictly, we'd have to say that there is a social benefit if the cost is negative of these CO2 emissions. And yet, nobody talks about that, probably because, first of all, the community that is pushing this issue does not want that to be out there, because it would be the end of the issue.
Let's talk about what has been said in the past. If you look at climate change, it used to be called global warming. So the euphemisms that are being used have changed over time, but they're meant to push a particular narrative. I still remember back in 1974, Time magazine had an article that talked about the coming global ice age. I bring that up because there are always periods in which there is cooling, there are periods in which there's warming. So climate change is something that we ought to take for granted. It is part of the warp and woof of what happens in climatology in general.
Correct. And so, if I could, how do you want to approach that subject?
Well, what I'm trying to get at here is that the narrative changes all the time and the euphemisms change. Now we're talking about climate change, but there's nothing particular controversial about climate change. Climate is always changing and the narrative is also changing. So it's a mixed bag. If you go back, as I said, to 1974, you have Time pontificating that we're headed into an ice age.
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened is, first of all, it didn't warm at the rate that it was supposed to warm. And nobody could really come up, in all seriousness, with it being a net negative. And so then people started to blame weather events rather than climate events. Climate is a long period phenomenon. They would take a hurricane that hit, say, in the Philippines and say, this is a severe hurricane because of global warming. Not actually questioning, are hurricanes becoming stronger or getting more frequent as the surface temperature goes up? The answer is there's no evidence at all for that on a global scale. But then every weather event is linked not to global warming, but to so-called climate change. And that, to me, has been what I would call the de-sciencing of the climate change issue, as the historian of science Karl Popper noted repeatedly. If you have a theory that explains everything, if you can ascribe anything to that theory, you're not doing science anymore because you have just come up with an untestable theory.
At our institute, we oftentimes talk about the fact that you have to learn to ask the right questions and ask the right questions in the right sequence. I did a podcast with Dr. Jay Richards, and he was talking about the fact that we need to pose the question, is the Earth warming? How much is the Earth warmed? If it is warming, is human activity causing it? If it's warming, is that actually bad overall? And suppose it's warming and we're causing it and it's bad, would implementing any of the policies around today make a difference, or would their cost exceed the benefits? So you have to learn discernment skills with this whole subject, because somehow or other you have to cut through the fog of the narrative, and people have to be able to get to some place of comfort with this issue because they're startled. The average person is startled and they don't know what to think. They hear someone like Cortez talking about the fact that we have 12 years, or Beto O'Rourke saying we have 10 years, or as I mentioned in the introduction, you have Al Gore saying back in 2006, we have essentially 10 years to save the planet. So they hear these kinds of alarmist pontifications and they don't know what to make of it.
Of course. And, you know, I think people also get rightfully tired of these pronouncements. I mean, they can see that, generally speaking, people are much better off than they were 100 years ago. In fact, in the industrialized world, life expectancy has approximately doubled, and per capita wealth has gone up roughly 11-fold. I'm not saying that global warming caused that, but it sure as heck didn't stop it. And people know that. They pick that up. And that's one of the reasons they're very skeptical. And in fact, I think the louder people scream about it, the more people get turned off by the issue, because they can see all these things.
I hope you're right about that. You think back to, you mentioned the previous administration where Obama made this the second most significant issue in his inauguration speech. After healthcare, he talked about the global warming crisis and what needed to be done. And if, in fact, these kinds of politicians have their way, we're going to spend tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy with our eye on the wrong ball.
That is correct. But, you know, I don't think people really, really want to do that because, first of all, they know people like me, malcontents like me, will actually put out some facts, like if the United States cut its emissions to zero today and kept them at zero all the way to the year 2100, that using the UN's computer models and the models that the Obama administration liked so much, that would only reduce net warming by a couple of tenths of a degree Celsius. It would reduce it maybe from, you know, 3.2 to 3.0 degrees Celsius, if you believe those models. So what in the world can we do about this issue that's reasonable? And the answer is probably continue to do what we have been doing, which is create things more efficiently or create things that work more efficiently. We can see that in the switchover from coal to natural gas for electrical generation. As a result, the United States has dropped its net emissions of carbon dioxide more than any other industrialized country on Earth. And we did it without the Paris Accord. We did it with simply a free market. And very smart people discovering how to very effectively break the rocks underneath our feet and release natural gas from shale formations down there. And we have hundreds of years worth of that. So the economy will continue to become more efficient over time.
Talk about the different computer models and the danger inherent in extrapolating trends.
Yeah, well, we have to go again by the latest model compendium, which was actually out in 2013 from the United Nations. The new one is going to be coming out, I think, later this year or early next year. And it will have a slightly different family of models. Ironically, I think they might even be hotter than the current family, which is going to make them off by even more than the current ones are off. But the United Nations has about 32 different families of models, and you can look and how well they track temperature changes in the areas of the planet that are climatically very critical. I would pick on the tropics, the lower atmosphere between, say, 20 degrees north latitude and 20 degrees south latitude. And what you can see is all the models are way off, predicting several times more warming than is being observed in the upper levels of the lower atmosphere. That has enormous consequences because almost all the moisture that falls in the mid-latitudes in the United States, for example, originates in the tropics. And that gets into the air based upon how buoyant the tropical air is. These models are predicting the air to become less buoyant, which would inject less moisture into the atmosphere. That would probably not be a good thing, but in fact, it's changing very, very little. And we find no real evidence for systematic and predictable large changes in precipitation anywhere on Earth. I would like to segue into how people abuse this issue. The whole problem in Syria, ISIS, and all this unrest and all this killing, the Obama folk could glibly claim that that was caused by global warming. Well, I took a look at what the computer models say should be happening in that part of the world, and they do indeed project slight decreases in precipitation. But what's really gone on in Syria over the course of the last 40 years or so is rainfall has dropped a mere 10%, which is a drop in the bucket, literally. And the population has gone up 300%. So what strains the infrastructure more? A 10% change in precipitation or a 300% change in the number of people using that precipitation? I assure you it's the latter.
When you read headlines in USA Today like CO2 levels are the highest in human history, higher than at any time in 800,000 years, higher than before the time that modern humans came into existence, that carbon dioxide has reached levels in our atmosphere not seen in 3 million years and so forth. Very, very difficult for the average person to process. And at some point in time, I suppose what you're saying is true, the baloney detector goes off and they're saying, yeah, I'm not believing any of this.
Yeah, that does happen. I mean, if you want to see, you know, climate change that's fairly significant, you can go to the high-latitude land areas of the Northern Hemisphere. They've warmed up a fair amount. But most of the rest of the planet, not so much, and mainly, again, in the cold seasons, in the winter and at night. It's very hard to melt Antarctica by warming up the night, because the nighttime temperatures there, remember, Antarctica, most of it is below the Antarctic Circle, so there's perpetual night, very long nights as you get closer and closer to the South Pole. And warming that up, you're never going to get it to above freezing. I can tell you that. Antarctica is this gigantic mass of ice. People do not realize how big it is. And it's really, really stable. It began to form, by the way, when the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere was quite a bit higher than it is today.
What are the motivations involved in all of that? I know that it's difficult to parse that out. But is this about people sitting in a smoky room somewhere saying we're going to find a way to garner a program that confiscates tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy? Or how does a narrative like this come into existence?
Well, in some cases, what you say, people sitting around a smoky room and saying that's what they really want to do, that does happen. The folks at the UN who put together the so-called Agenda 21, which really is a roadmap to do exactly what you're talking about. They did consciously do so. And then there are also people who, you know, everybody likes to think that they're saving the world, whether the world needs saving or not, and therefore being concerned about global warming, and I'll use global warming rather than climate change, because all the things that happen as a result of the changes in carbon dioxide are feared or not feared, all those things are a result of the warming of the lower atmosphere. So let's keep our eye on the ball. Anyway, people use global warming as virtue signaling. If they care about it, and if they besmirch anybody who doesn't agree with them, they think they're virtue signaling. This is really very modern secular religion, unfortunately, with many of the intolerances that seem to come with some religions.
And there are stakeholder interests and incentives. There's motivated blindness, which inhibits a person's ability to perceive inconvenient data. There's shoddy research. And then you have the water carriers in the media that are putting forth that shoddy research as though it's well-established scientific consensus and so forth. So you have all those sociological factors as well.
And but you have people not asking simple critical questions. I always like it whenever I read a news story or hear one that says that global warming is going to increase mental illness. Well, I guess that's a very testable thing. Instead of having the planet warm, let's move the people to a warmer place. When they move from New York to Miami, do they go nuts? Does their mental health decline? Apparently not. So these glib pronouncements can be so easily tested with a little bit of logic. And the fact that some of the media figures in this seem to function more in a data-free and fact-free environment than they should.
You're talking about the virtue signaling as well, but if you think about this, what's going on right now, if in fact these policies get implemented, is really going to help the people that are rich and hurt the people that are poor. I mean, if energy costs increase, it's not going to hurt rich people, it's going to hurt poor people. And not only that, if you start spending tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy on this issue, it takes your eye off the wrong ball. For $200 billion, you can provide fresh water for people that don't have it now. So you start funneling money in bad directions.
Yes, that is true. And as you say, rich people are not nearly as affected by it as poor people. And by extension, what these policies do is they limit poor nations, condemn them to underdevelopment, to poverty, all the things that we think are not so good, and do it in the name of virtue signaling for the developed world. Not a very good idea, if you ask me.
Talk about consensus science for a moment. So often you have these consensus claims that get bundled together.
Oh, the 97% of scientists agree that this is a horrible issue or something like that.
Yeah.
You hear that one all the time. And a wise friend of mine, Dr. Terence Keeley, who was president of a university over there in the United Kingdom, and we've worked together a fair amount, once observed that in virtually anything, 97% of scientists agree. You know, was it 20 years ago, 97% of medical scientists agreed babies should sleep on their backs or sleep on their stomachs, whatever it is, and 5 years later, that changed completely. And now babies, if 97% of people agree that babies should sleep in the opposite direction, if you will, that 97% of scientists thought they should just a few years earlier. That's because scientists like to go along. I mean, if you disagree with a paradigm in science, if you disagree with a large majority of view, you're not going to have a very good time, and you're going to be attacked a lot. So really, there's a big herd instinct in science that most of the public is not generally aware of, but happens to be true.
There is a herd instinct. There's no question about that. I mean, that's happened throughout human history.
Yep, it has. That's correct.
Absolutely. And then you have the ad hominem attacks that you alluded to, the most famous of which is that if you don't believe in climate change or global warming, you're relegated to the status of a Holocaust denier.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I find that really disgusting because there's clearly fairly strong evidence that this issue is quite overblown.
And scientists are pressured, aren't they, to toe the party line because you have tenure and job promotions and government grants.
Yeah,
and
you only get that if you publish a lot of research. And, for example, in climate science, there's only one supporter of that research. That's the federal government. So if you write a grant proposal that says, I want it to be funded because I think this issue is overblown, you're going to get denied. Because the people that review that proposal are all the people that are in the funding stream. That's how they got the expertise to be able to review the proposal.
I saw you on Mark Levin's broadcast talking about the fact that we need another special counsel because the only climate models that correspond to reality happen to be Russian climate models.
Yes.
Tongue in cheek, obviously.
but you can plot out the models and compare them to observations. And what you see, again, is that all of them except one group, which is the Russian model, are dramatically over-predicting warming. The Russian model's really good. And if we were using what I'd call best scientific practice, well, what we would do is we wouldn't take all 32 model families, average them up, and do the uncertainty of the model by the spread of the 32 model results. No, you would take what a weather forecaster does every day. They take the model that appears to be working in the recent past or in the weather forecast problem that's up for today. You don't average them all up. And so if we were following best scientific practice for the climate forecast, the same best scientific practice that's used on the weather forecast, we would be using the Russian model INMCM4. There is a revision of that that is slowly leaking into the literature, not surprisingly, INMCM5. And the one thing that I have noticed about it is it picks up the so-called pause in warming from roughly year 2000 to year 2014. That pause was a real embarrassment to the modeling community, and so the response of the scientific community, the bigwigs in it, was to change the data, not to change the models. And the world temperature records were revised with a method that was guaranteed to put some warming in that period where there wasn't much, if any. Now the Russian model comes out and indeed simulates the same pause that was observed.
Do governments have more than one model? Let's say, do the Russian government have numerous models?
They probably do, but they don't all go into this pot that the United Nations, actually it's our Department of Energy, assembles it for the United Nations. And, for example, in the United States, I think, God, we must have four or five, maybe seven or eight of those models. You know, a couple of them come from the United Kingdom, maybe one from France, etc. They all give slightly different results, but INMCM4 gives the best result and has less warming in it than any of the others. If we adopted INMCM4, it would kill the issue.
What have been the consequences for you personally as a result of not marching with the herd?
It wasn't really very pleasant at UVA, University of Virginia. The governor exerted pressure on the president, and that filtered down through the university to make my life somewhat miserable. And finally, I got sick of it, and then went to work for a think tank in Washington, Cato Institute. I was with them for a long, long time. Now I'm with something called the Carbon Dioxide Coalition, and I probably will be with another think tank called the Competitive Enterprise Institute in the very near future. You know, it just requires some moving around, but I've always had fun. I especially enjoyed that interview with Mark Levin because he really wanted to get to the bottom of the issue. I've never seen somebody not interrupt, let people give answers that are longer than a soundbite on live TV. He was great. And so that's the kind of thing that, you know, I've been able to do, and I rather like that.
And I think what you've gone through is a microcosm of what untenured scientists go through. If you're tenured, if you're older, if you're retired, you can speak your mind. But if you're not, I mean, if you're trying to make it up through the ranks, it's very, very difficult to go against the herd mentality. But science, as you've alluded to, has always progressed by people going against the herd. I mean, when Einstein came out with E equals MC squared, that was thought to be an outrageous idea, didn't comport with reality, and he was castigated.
Oh, sure.
People forget that.
There's no doubt about that. And, you know, I could imagine the analogy to a congressional hearing, you know, where somebody would stand up and say, Mr. Einstein, you're saying that time moves slower as we approach the speed of light. So I take it if you drive fast, that you will get less time will elapse compared to your surroundings. You know, you could just ridicule somebody with that. But yeah, that's what happens when the political process starts to intervene with scientific creativity.
What's really interesting is the way in which fear now is used as a motivator. I was struck by a New York Times piece. It was an opinion piece titled Time to Panic. It was written by David Wallace Wells. He is the author of a book titled The Uninhabitable Earth. And the subhead of the piece dogmatically declared that the planet is getting warmer in catastrophic ways, and then that fear may be the only thing that saves us. So now we're peddling fear.
That's true. But again, I think the more that's peddled, it's something you can't do continuously because people will see through it. They'll see that they're actually doing okay. And so I do think that that's, if somebody really wants to, quote, do something about this, I'm not so sure there's really anything you can do. But if somebody really has that feeling, trying to continually scare people is going to backfire and probably already has. I call your attention to the election of 2016 in the United States. There was a component of that dynamic operating in that election.
I wrote a book in 1999 called The Millennium Bug Debugged. And the subhead of that book was the facts behind all the Y2K sensationalism. And if you recall back then, people in the spiritual community and the secular community united in lockstep, as it were talking about a millennium bug or Y2K that would be the end of human civilization as we knew it. In the Christian community, you had the top luminaries, people like James Dobson or James Kennedy or R.C. Sproul, great people in their own right, many of them friends of mine, but they were lockstep saying that Y2K was going to be a catastrophe. They were selling books and freeze-dried food and so forth. And people were buying into it en masse. And when I said in my book that Y2K wouldn't even be a top 10 news story in the year 2000, I had people saying that I was going to have the blood of millions of people on my hands because I was causing complacency within the body of Christ, in this case, in the spiritual realm. In the secular realm, I was doing shows like, back then it was Hannity and Combs, and both of them, from the left and the right, Hannity taking the right position and Combs taking the left position, were both arguing against the idea that this was a non-issue, that this was about sophistry and sensationalism and selling fear and these kinds of things, that it had no basis in reality whatsoever. In fact, within our own research institute, we had people saying, better tread lightly, because what if this really does happen? That's the end of the institute. But it was mining the subjunctive. It was cultivating the seed of threat buried in each unrealized instance. But the great thing about that issue was there was a termination date.
Correct.
And so you could tell whether this was really true or wasn't. Climate change doesn't have a termination date.
No, it doesn't. And when it becomes obvious that certain aspects of it, important, critical aspects, aren't panning out as they were forecast to, then the termination date just slips and goes forward.
Exactly. It just keeps moving forward.
Exactly. I remember a guy that I've had several scientific disagreements with, Ben Santer from Lawrence Livermore Lab, somewhere back there said, you know, if we didn't get warming for 15 years, then there would be something wrong. And then it got to 17 years. No, we actually meant 20, something like that. Yeah, that kind of stuff happens.
Kind of summarize this for people listening in, Dr. Michael. So often, people need to get this distilled in such a way that they can get a grasp on it. When they're reading the newspaper, how can they exercise discernment skills? What questions should they be asking in their minds?
Well, they should ask critical questions. I will go back to one example that I just brought up, which is these stories that, scientists say global warming will increase mental illness. Well, fine. Then document for me that if a person moves from Washington, D.C. to Richmond, which is about a degree warmer, that they will lose a certain amount of their sanity. I don't think anybody can document that. People should just ask themselves obvious questions like that when you read stories like that.
So you have to learn discernment skills. You have to learn to ask the right questions in the right sequence. And, maybe we can go through those real quickly. Is the Earth warming? You're saying, yes, it is, but it's less than a degree Celsius.
Warming attributable to greenhouse gas changes probably has a maximum value of around between 5/10 and 6/10 of a degree Celsius. The overall warming of the surface temperatures has been around a degree Celsius, a little bit less than twice, perhaps, the human input. But that warming, there were two warmings of the 20th century. One of them started in 1910 and ended around 1945. That couldn't have anything to do with us putting CO2 in the air. If the very slight changes in CO2 between the background and 1910, if those excited essentially a half a degree of warming, then it would be so hot now we wouldn't even be talking about it, because it would mean the sensitivity of temperature to carbon dioxide would be exceedingly high. By the way, those computer models, for some reason, are all backfit, parameterized, they call it, to somehow tell us that the warming of the early 20th century was caused by humans, and all warming, all change since the Industrial Revolution is a result of human influence on the climate. That's becoming the latest heresy, and that's such an easy takedown. I can't believe it can survive.
Is that parameterizing that you talk about something that's intentional?
It's secular for fudging.
Yeah.
Because there are many processes in the atmosphere that we really don't know. We really can't quantify them very well. But they're required in order to have a working climate model. And so guesses are taken at certain values. This all began to come out in late 2016 with the acceptance of a paper in a very important atmospheric science journal, the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. And the paper was called The Art and Science of Model Tuning. And in it, I mean, the great climate scientist Judith Curry wrote in her blog, if you're going to read one paper in your life on climate modeling, read that paper. It is amazing that these parameters are fiddled with. And I'm just using the words of the author, Frederick Hordan, right now, to get the, quote, anticipated acceptable range, end quote, of climate change. In other words, if our model gives significantly more warming than the rest of the community of models, that model is going to be adjusted to get it back in line. That's what happened with the German Max Planck Institute model in the current United Nations model family. When they were just about to send it in to become an official member of the family in what's called the frozen code version, in other words, the sort of the official final be-all and end-all of this model, it had 7 degrees Celsius of warming in it for doubling carbon dioxide. That was way out of line with all the others. And as they told Science Magazine, this is Science Magazine they're quoted in, we had to get that number down, end quote. Now, answer me this. What's giving us the result here? Objective scientific models or subjective scientists fiddling with the models to get an answer that doesn't irritate their colleagues too much? It's the latter.
Yeah, it's absolutely the quintessence of a rhetorical question. What about human activity? You alluded to this, but you're saying human activity is not a major part of the equation. Is that correct?
Well, it's a significant part, but it's not the only thing that's going on. I mean, we have the warming. The rate of warming in the early 20th century isn't much different than the rate of warming in the later 20th century, but we hadn't put enough CO2 in the air to cause that warming in the early 20th century. So,
well, what I mean is, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but if in fact we did everything, let's say, that the Paris Accords or the Kyoto Protocol demanded, if every single country, including China and India, complied, would that solve the problem?
If they did what they said they were going to do, no. No. It would probably reduce warming to the year 2100 by about 0.4 of a degree Celsius. So, no, that's not it. But the Paris Agreement is a joke anyway. It's not enforceable. There's no enforcement mechanism. Each country...
Unless you shame the countries.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get to that in a second. No, you could put in your own goals. It's like writing your own final exam, okay, with the book in front of you. So the Indian pledge, if you will, the people of India, the government of India said, well, as you know, as economies develop, they actually become more efficient. they generally use lower carbon dioxide emissions either per capita or per unit economic output. That's called the emissions intensity of carbon dioxide. It drops naturally as the efficiencies of a large-scale economy come into play. The Indians pledged to reduce their emissions intensity at a rate lower than it was being reduced naturally. In other words, they purposely pledged to emit more per unit GDP than they would have if they just left things alone. The Chinese, that was a great breakthrough. You may recall, they said that they were going to attempt to, that's my words, they were going to attempt to stabilize their emissions around the year 2030. Well, there are several papers that came out years before the Chinese made that so-called commitment that predicted that because of the simple process of economic maturation, Chinese emissions are probably going to stabilize around the year 2030. So they agreed to do something that the experts pretty much suspected was going to happen if they did nothing. And the United States, on the other hand, does something that's quite tangible. And we reduce our emissions, gross emissions of carbon dioxide, more than any other large industrialized nation on Earth since 2005. And then we get out of the Paris Agreement because it was irrelevant to those emissions reductions. And I think that the president had a very good point that the agreement was unfair, that it, he didn't come out and say this, but that it allowed countries like India and China just to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, and everybody would clap their hands and say, oh, look, even the Indians and the Chinese are going along when they agreed to do absolutely nothing. So, yeah, the Paris Agreement's a joke.
Let me ask you a politically incorrect question. Is warming actually bad overall? In other words, if there's a slight warming trend, is that bad? That's sort of in concert with asking the question about CO2. I mean, CO2 is plant food. It creates longer growing seasons, the greening of the planet, and so forth. So it's not necessarily bad. I mean, too much CO2 is obviously bad, but is a little warming actually bad overall?
Well, there are some econometric models that suggest that warming up to about 2 degrees Celsius, maybe even a little bit more than that, in general is a net benefit. You know, we weren't given the best of all possible climates when we had the Industrial Revolution. We had a climate that probably was a little cold for climates since the end of the Ice Age, which would be for the last about 11,000 years or so. And so, yeah, it's quite possible that a little warming is okay. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when people are at the end of their professionally productive lives and they want to retire or go somewhere, they don't go to Greenland. They go to where it's warmer. And I think that says something about what human beings really want.
And we've already talked about this, but maybe a little bit of elaboration would be helpful. Suppose it is warming. Suppose we are causing it, so we're conceding to a number of the propositions within the narrative. Let's suppose it's bad. Would implementing any of the policies around today make a difference, or would
No.
the cost exceed the benefit?
No. You have to have a replacement source of dense energy. And for some reason, the same people that are so concerned about carbon dioxide emissions and global warming, a large percent of that community seems to be adamantly opposed to the only really viable dense energy alternative, which is nuclear fission. And, you know, they watch too many horror movies. I've been watching the HBO series Chernobyl. I don't know if you – are you aware of this one?
Yeah.
I think it's really well done. Don't get me wrong. But that's the propaganda film that's going to have the same effect as the propaganda film the China Syndrome had in the late 1970s. You do know that Three Mile Island, one of the reactors at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, has a slight meltdown.
I do,
And I believe it was in 79. It's the same day, this is such an ironic thing, the same day that the largest deposit of uranium in the United States was discovered. And if I tell you where it is, you won't believe it. You think it's out west. You think it's in the mountains. No, it's along the Virginia-North Carolina border. Near in Pennsylvania County, down by the state line there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm telling you that, among other things, that's an indication that we have quite a bit of fuel there and have a source of electricity that is very dense, very concentrated, and doesn't emit any carbon dioxide to speak of. And so if you're all concerned about this issue, and you, for some reason, are adamantly opposed to nuclear, I will say in my own mind, this guy's not serious. He's got an ulterior motive, because if he were serious, he'd do that.
Talk a little bit about your book, Scientocracy. I'm really interested in the debut of that book.
Yeah, it's due to come out the first week in November. It's a book that talks about the unintended consequences, or maybe they are intended, I don't know, of the way that we reward and fund scientists, and how that results in these bandwagons, you know, these 97% deals, some of which are horrifically wrong. And one of the sections of the book is on the regulation of carcinogens, ionizing radiation, and chemicals. And the model that's used is just wrong. It says that the first molecule of a carcinogen or the first photon of ionizing radiation is just as capable of causing cancer as the bajillionth one because of their propensity to break strands of DNA. Well, the fact of the matter is we are surrounded by electromagnetic radiation, and it's probably breaking DNA strands all the time. Since this standard was put out, it was in the process of being discovered that we have our own self-repair mechanism for DNA, and it's only when that gets overwhelmed by really large amounts of radiation that trouble begins to set in. So the entire paradigm for regulation of all the things around us, all the ionizing radiation, chemicals, carcinogens, you name it, is wrong. And you know, there's one guy, usually there's like one or two guys that just, they're nuts. Guys like me, you know, bulldogs are going to start tearing apart things and say, hey, what's under this skirt? You know, and this guy by the name of Edward Calabrese from the University of Massachusetts School of Public Health, and he has torn this thing apart. He has gone into the declassified records of the Atomic Energy Commission radiation panels and discovered that they knew that this whole standard, which is called the linearity, no threshold standard, was wrong. They knew it was wrong at the time. But you know why they did it? And Calabrese would come out and say this, but I know. That came out, that concept was developed during the era of atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons. And everybody's afraid of the fallout, you know, that it's going to cause cancer because strontium-90, strontium's in the same column of the periodic table as calcium is, and so it gets picked up just like calcium gets picked up out of milk. It will get picked up out of milk. And this was horrible, and I think these guys thought if we frighten everybody and say that, you know, unless you stop these small amounts of radiation that are dispersing worldwide, unless you stop that, everybody's going to die or there's going to be a dramatic increase in cancer. They were doing something they thought was virtuous. They were exaggerating for the greater good. And how many issues does that happen in, huh? Think about, okay, climate change. How about high carbohydrate, low-fat diets? How's that work out? Seems to correlate with the development of a large amount of diabetes in the United States and the countries that adopted it. The people that put that out, they weren't trying to kill people. They thought they were doing good. They wouldn't accept other points of view, but they thought they were doing good.
And if you extrapolate that then, and you look at modern-day politicians like AOC or Beto O'Rourke, who seem to be water carriers for a particular narrative, maybe they think they're doing something good, but they never asked the right questions. They've simply gone with the conclusion without doing the necessary research.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true. And I noticed AOC's latest line that she was just kidding. Hopefully she wasn't kidding.
Well, why do you think she said that? Do you just think that the
scorn and abuse heaped upon her for implying that if we didn't do something in 12 years, that would be the end of civilization. I think that got to be a bit much for her.
But people have such short memory spans. I mean, I mentioned earlier that you have Beto O'Rourke using the 10-year, the decade number. But that was precisely what Al Gore did in 2006, and people have forgotten in 2016 that he made that prediction. In the Christian world, people have been making predictions with respect to the end of the world, and the predictions don't come through, and then a few months later, they have another bestseller coming out, Four Blood Moons or whatever, and some other nonsense, some other conspiracy theory, and the book sells again, because people aren't critical thinkers and they have short attention spans.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of truth to that. But when we get into the realm of policy debates where the policies are going to cost people a lot of money or require rather drastic changes in their lifestyle, at that point, usually somebody remembers that somebody said this was going to happen 10 years ago, and we're just sitting here fine, sitting here pretty 10 years after it was said that 10 years was all we had. That will come up in those policy discussions. And again, I think there is a certain amount of, if you want to coin a phrase, I was credited with coining this phrase on CNN many, many moons ago. I think people are developing apocalypse fatigue. Look up the American Slang Dictionary. You'll see when its first usage was.
Well, look, this was a fascinating discussion. Is there anything else you want to leave people with? I mean, you're leaving people with a little bit of optimism that ultimately the vast number of people out there that are going to be affected by the policies are going to rebel against the policies, and they're not going to continue buying into it. So that's optimistic. Anything else?
Well, if history is any guide, it will be the children of the millennials.
The children of the millennials. Why is that?
Because the millennials are buying into it.
So it's the children of the millennials that will debunk it.
Well,
I appreciate the time you spent with us. It was very informative. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
And for everybody else listening in, do remember that the Hank Unplugged podcast is dependent on you, in part for its popularity. Share it with others and go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, or make sure that you let your family and friends know about the Hank Unplugged podcast. Again, this podcast is devoted to bringing the most informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to you. And you can find archived editions of Hank Unplugged on the web at equip.org. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of Hank Unplugged.
Thank you for listening to the Hank Unplugged podcast. During the critical month of June, we prayerfully ask you to consider making a financial gift of support to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth. As we approach our financial year end, June 30th, you can give online simply by visiting equip.org, or you can call 888-7000-CRI. CRI's outreaches are funded solely by listeners like you. Be sure to join us again for the next edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast.